case, Gayos Vasquez versus the United States. Mr. Ripple. Is there a Barnes and Thornburg bus today, or?
I think it's a Toyota Camry, actually. Mr. Barrett's driving. May it please the court. As you know, I represent the petitioner appellant in this case, Carlos Gallo Vasquez, who is appealing the summary dismissal of his Section 2255 motion to vacate his sentence from the Northern District of Illinois. Mr. Gallo Vasquez is entitled to an evidentiary hearing on his motion. Because his motion and the record and files of his case do not conclusively show that he is entitled to no relief. In particular, Mr. Gallo Vasquez argues that he received ineffective assistance of counsel twice by two separate attorneys during his original case. First, at the trial level, his trial counsel did not use an interpreter when discussing with Mr. Gallo Vasquez the decision whether or not to plead guilty or proceed to trial and any potential plea agreement that may be raised. And then secondly, after his conviction on his subsequent appeal to this court, he contends that he received ineffective assistance when his appellate lawyer did not explain to him that there are certain risks associated with an appeal, that it was potentially possible for the government to take a cross appeal and attack the sentencing he had received at the district court level, and as a result have the case remanded and his sentence enhanced, which indeed happened. The records and files of the case do not conclusively show that Mr. Gallo Vasquez was not entitled to some relief, and therefore an evidentiary hearing should have taken place to allow him to present the evidence in support of his claims.
Does the recent Supreme Court case of Booker have any impact on this?
Not on the issues that the certificate of appealability was granted on. He was sentenced for factors, in my opinion, which Booker and Fanfan apply to, but that wasn't briefed. And it is our contention that because it potentially announces a new rule of law, retroactivity seems to be in some debate, that potentially this would be one of those situations where 2255 would allow Mr. Gallo Vasquez to file a subsequent motion in the district court after this court and the Supreme Court to decide that issue. But the government urges the court to affirm the summary dismissal and to adopt a strict standard enunciated by Judge Coffey in his concurrence and dissent in Patras versus the United States that would require the petitioner to supply objective evidence in support of his motion before the district court would be required to hold an evidentiary hearing. It is our position that the objective evidence requirement is not required by Section 2255, would serve to weed out but would otherwise may serve to be valid claims by petitioners and may be inconsistent with the Supreme Court standard they set forth in Strickland for ineffective assistance of counsel. Section 2255 requires notice to be served upon the United States attorney and a prompt hearing held unless the motion and the files and records of the case conclusively show that the prisoner is entitled to no relief. There is no mention in Section 2255 of objective evidence. And quite frankly, I think the language of the statute contemplates that more than just the petitioner's motion will be viewed by the district court. The files and records of the case are to be examined as well. And only if, when after looking at the motion, any attached exhibits, and the files and records of the case, only then if the district court is convinced that conclusively there is no basis for relief, a hearing can be denied. It seems that 2255, therefore, gives something of the benefit of the doubt to the prisoner. If the prisoner's petition were to contradict the record, obviously no hearing is necessary. But if the record is ambiguous, or if there's absence of record. I don't believe 2255 allows the district court to preclude an evidentiary hearing. The standard in the statute is that the files and records and the motion must conclusively show. So if there is ambiguity, if the record is silent, or if there is material from outside the record, which the prisoner alleges in this case would show ineffective assistance of counsel, Section 2255 requires an evidentiary hearing to take place. The objective evidence standard.
Well, this ineffective assistance with regard to not having a translator?
We would contend in either place, either a translator in the trial court or in the appellate counsel. The objective evidence standard for the appellate counsel would be a difficult burden for my client to overcome. There's nothing in the record concerning discussions between him and his appellate counsel because of the attorney-client privilege, nonetheless.
Well, he wrote a letter to Judge Castillo, didn't he?
He did, shortly before trial, regarding his trial counsel.
And he write it in English?
Yes. My client has some knowledge of English.
He was faced with a brilliant opportunity because the trial bench speaks fluent Spanish.
I'm not sure my client was aware that Judge Castillo was fluent in Spanish.
Well, if we were, Ruben Castillo may give you some idea. That
hint along the line, yeah.
Well, a hint. I have a family.
Oh, I confess I can't speak German. I don't know.
Say I have a family member who speaks fluent French, but you wouldn't get it from my last name.
But I guess my point is, it's just unnecessary to have a hearing if it's obvious on its face, right?
Correct. If it's obvious on its face, no hearing is necessary. However, the appellate counsel argument doesn't have so much to do with the translator, though we would contend that discussions between an attorney and his client about the pros and cons of appealing a translator should be present, just to make sure that there is full communication. If you read things my client has written, even in English, it's clear that he doesn't have a thorough understanding of the language.
Well, your client was thoroughly convinced that he would be proven innocent, which means he'd have to take the position that he was innocent. So to try and talk him out of an appeal after he's been found guilty might be also a problem, huh?
Well, his appeal didn't question the conviction. He just simply appealed his sentence. He appealed his sentence and said there was enough. The issue that he presented on appeal was there was not enough evidence in the record to justify the trial court sentence enhancement on the basis that I was a ringleader, that I supervised five or more people in a criminal enterprise. That's a weak appeal. That's deficient performance, in our opinion. There's ample evidence in the trial court record that my client supervised the unloading of the marijuana from the truck, that he signed the bill of lading. Other witnesses testified that he directed them and offered to pay them more money. If that's the only argument you're going to make on appeal, it's definitely not an appeal worth making. And that should have been conveyed to my client. So that's deficient performance number one, I think, by appellate counsel. Appellate counsel number two, the second problem with appellate counsel is that he didn't warn my client that there was an opportunity for the government to take a cross appeal or even an original appeal and challenge the downward departure Judge Castillo granted him on the basis of his status as a deportable alien. Case law in this circuit was quite clear that that didn't justify a downward departure under the sentencing guidelines. It was a risk not worth taking. The government contends in their appeal, in their brief, that they intended to appeal the downward departure regardless of whether Mr. Gallo-Vasquez appealed his sentence or his conviction. Again, there's no evidence in the record of that. They did at sentencing argue against a downward departure, but that's no guarantee that they would have taken appeal. Parties all the time, including the government, raise issues before the trial court that they choose later not
to. You think it was just an empty threat? You don't trust the government, I can tell.
Well, it's the defense lawyer in me that you have to take it all with a grain of salt.
They had a right to appeal, and they said they were going to appeal, but you didn't believe it.
My client contends that he was never told that they had a right to appeal and therefore didn't realize there was a risk in submitting his appeal. Mm. I see my time is up. If there are no further questions.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Ripple. Mr. Drury?
May it please the court, counsel. Your Honors, this appeal raises two issues. The first issue is when is a Section 2255 movement required to come forward with proof of his claims? And second is whether the district court properly entered the summary dismissal of petitioner's Section 2255 motion. Turning to the first issue, when is a Section 2255 movement required to come forward with proof of his claims? This is an issue that this court has not ruled on. As set forth in the government's brief, it is the government's position that a Section 2255 movement is required to come forward with actual or objective proof of his claims at the time he files his motion. This interpretation of the proof requirements of Section 2255 is supported both by the relevant statute and procedural rules as well as this court's precedent. For instance, Rule 4B of the rules governing Section 2255 proceedings specifically gives the district court the discretion to summarily dismiss a Section 2255 motion. The purpose of that rule, as set forth in the advisory committee notes, is to allow a district court to weed out frivolous claims. Certainly, if a petitioner was required to come forward with nothing more than his bare assertions that are unsupported by anything, there would be no need for Rule 4B. Every petition would go forward. This court has also recognized the need for a petitioner to come forward with something more than his bare assertions at the time he files his claim. This court has repeatedly held that actual proof beyond bare assertions is required in order for a Section 2255 motion to move forward. Thus, from a legal standpoint, the government's position is supported. Further, the government's position is supported by public policy.
Does the government take the position that a failure to tell the defendant when he's discussing an appeal that if you do appeal, it's possible the government will cross appeal and you'll get whacked right between the ears? Do you think the failure to do that, would you agree, was a failure that a competent counsel shouldn't have been involved with?
Your Honor, if I understand your question correctly,
does the defense counsel appointed or hired have the affirmative duty to inform his client that if you appeal, the government may cross appeal?
Your Honor, I don't believe that there is an affirmative duty to do that. A counsel has the affirmative duty to counsel his client if his client seeks.
But is one of those pieces of counseling, does it require that the ramifications of what you're undertaking have to be made clear to the defendant?
Your Honor, appellate counsel should discuss the pros and cons of making
including the fact that the government has a right to cross appeal.
That probably should be made aware by appellate counsel.
If they fail to do that, what?
Well, in this instance, if they fail to do it, which is not supported by the record, that it was failed to be done.
Well, let's assume that if there was a failure to warn, is that an indication of incompetence?
Your Honor, I do not believe that it is an indication of incompetence.
Well, I'm not sure what the result would be anyway. I mean, assuming that he wouldn't bring the appeal, the government still has the right to proceed.
That's exactly right, Your Honor. And furthermore, mere bad advice by an attorney does not constitute ineffective assistance of a counsel in and of itself. As I'll get to, turning to the second point just briefly, ineffective assistance of counsel requires a two-part test. First, the petitioner has the burden of showing that counsel's assistance fell below an objectively reasonable standard. And second, the petitioner must show that he was prejudiced by the counsel's claimed ineffective assistance. And the burden is on the defendant to make out this claim. And as the courts have repeatedly held, it's a heavy burden because counsel's assistance is presumed to be effective. Here,
counsel, did you, by any chance, I'm not necessarily that you would have to, but did you listen to the oral argument before the court in this case? I mean, the original appeal?
I did not, Your Honor. I was not even with the U.S. Attorney's Office at that time.
I mean, it's available, but you can go back and listen to it.
I have not, Your
Honor. Because sometimes we ask, did you advise your client that he risks having an enhanced sentence if it goes back? And the lawyer has an opportunity to respond at that time. But
Your Honor, I was unaware of that. Turning back to the first issue of the standard that should be applied and the evidence that a petitioner is required to come forward with, is a matter of public policy. Requiring a petitioner to come forward with objective proof at the time he files his claim is good public policy. It conserves judicial resources at the earliest possible point. For instance, in this case, where a petitioner's claims are made out of whole cloth, as is demonstrated by the underlying record, it allows the district court judge, who is in the best position to evaluate the claim, to summarily dismiss that claim and gives the district court the opportunity to spend more time on the valid Section 2255 claims. So the government respectfully requests that this court take the opportunity and find that a Section 2255 movement is required to come forward with proof of his claims at the time he files his motion. Turning to the merits of the appeal, petitioner raises two issues. One, that his trial counsel is ineffective because he failed to bring an interpreter to their counseling sessions. And second, as we've already discussed, that his appellate counsel is ineffective for failing to give advice. With respect to his trial counsel, the underlying record simply does not support the claims that petitioner is making, and summary dismissal was appropriate for that. And summary dismissal was appropriate. First, summary dismissal was appropriate because the petitioner has not come forward with any objective proof of his claims. He merely filed a 13-page brief that he said was signed under penalty of perjury. But as the district court found at the sentencing, this defendant perjured himself at the trial when he claimed his innocence and claimed that he just happened to get off of an airplane and be asked to take all this marijuana off the truck. The district court also found the petitioner to be trying to manipulate the court. The record also shows that while petitioner states that his counsel was advising him not to take a plea, the letter that Your Honors was discussing said the exact opposite. So summary dismissal was appropriate because he failed to come forward with proof of his claims. It was also appropriate because it doesn't satisfy the Strickland test. There's absolutely no evidence that trial counsel was his assistance fell below an objectively reasonable standard, or that his performance prejudiced the defendant in any way whatsoever. With respect to the appellate counsel, the same thing, Your Honors. The underlying record does not support the petitioner's unsupported claims. If anything, these are claims where the petitioner has just said, my appellate counsel didn't tell me this, he didn't tell me that. What the underlying record shows is that the petitioner is willing to say whatever he feels is necessary to help himself out. At the trial level, he said, my lawyer's forcing me to go to trial when I want a plea. At the appellate level, at the Section 2250, at the habeas level, he's now saying, my trial lawyer wouldn't let me plead guilty and forced me to go to trial. The petitioner needs to come forward with something more than that. It's his burden to show that his counsel was unreasonable and that he was prejudiced, and there's simply nothing in the record to show prejudice. He's maintained his innocence throughout. He maintained he had no involvement in this, and the record supports the conclusion that he did not believe he should have got a supervisory role because he did not believe that he was involved in the crime to begin with. If Your Honors have no further questions, I will take this up.
Thank you, Mr. Drury. Mr. Whipple, your time had expired, but you may have a minute for rebuttal if you feel that's essential. All right. Thank you, Mr. Whipple. Thank you, Mr. Drury. Thanks to all counsel. Mr. Whipple, a special thanks is extended on behalf of the court to you and for so ably representing the petitioner, and a thanks to your firm for participating in supporting this effort. All right. Case is taken under advisement.